Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Joy White about her new book, Terraformed: Young Black Lives in the Inner City. So welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Dave.
This is a fascinating book, really, really interesting, both in terms of the kind of broad theoretical contribution it makes, in terms of giving a real sense of kind of place and the importance of places, but also being about music as well. And those three things I found just really interesting as I was reading it. And I guess the place to start with is where the book kind of came from, where the sort of ideas in the book came from. So can you tell me a bit about what got you interested in writing about music, places, and then these broader kind of theories around things like race and geography?
I think for me, my interest started probably at the point when I was entering, just before I was doing my PhD, and I was running a business in East London, in Newham, and we take young people on placement, so they come in to do their 2 week work experience. And that was what sparked my interest in, I was always interested in young people anyway. I trained as a teacher a long time ago, but didn't really practice. But we get this steady stream of young people who are maybe 14 or 15. And Newham's a very, very multicultural borough. I think it's up to 100 languages are spoken. So it didn't really matter what the cultural background of these young people were. It didn't matter whether they were boys or girls. They would all come in listening to the same music. They were all engaged in some way, either as a ringtone, which shows you how long ago it was, as a ringtone. We had one young man that spent quite a bit of time on MySpace. And when I was kind of, you know, asking what he was doing, he had this fan base of people for his music, the music that he was making. He was selling CDs of his own music in the playground. So all this kind of stuff. So the things that I was interested in, young people, enterprise, creative stuff, all kind of came together in looking at grime, where it came from, who was making it, and what the social, cultural, and economic impact of creating that music was. And I was looking at young people who weren't categorized as being achievers. I'm using that word very carefully. So these were the young people that the school said weren't going to get 5 A star to C GCSEs, which was the pathway into further education and success. And I was just intrigued by these young people that were categorized as being not in education, employment and training. And because Newham's a multicultural borough, the majority of those young people were from were black and from ethnic minority backgrounds. And how can all of these things be true? How can these young people be underachieving in a school system, but achieving in other places and making something out of nothing? And I think that whole history of grime emerging from East London in the early part of the 21st century, you know, young people coming together in these kind of communal spaces in the, with this kind of edgy, hard-fought conviviality, all of these kind of Black Atlantic influences all come together in these spaces to create this music that was, yeah, just something else for me. I grew up in an era of sound systems and dancehall, so even though grime was a soundtrack of life in East London, if you knew any young people, I hadn't really paid that much attention to it until about 2006, 2007. And in a way, some of the themes that I touch on in Terraformed come out of that project, but it extended in different directions to look at young Black people's lives in a different way and from different perspectives.
I mean, you mentioned kind of extending a project. I guess the other thing happening is a project gets located really, kind of really clearly in the context of, you know, not even just kind of East London, but the Borough of Newham and Forest Gate. And I was really sort of fascinated in the way that that place is, you know, kind of the star of the show, I guess, throughout the book. Mm. But it's dealt with as a site of, you know, as much as kind of like social struggle for control of space as it is, you know, as a place that clearly, you know, you've got a real kind of like warmth and fondness for. But you're pretty kind of candid about the problems in the place. And these are problems that, you know, deal with things like gentrification and the problems of, you know, transformations of the state and privatization and outsourcing, all of which I think, you know, we'll come on to talk about. But the place to really kind of to get a sense of how these maybe grand sort of sociological issues play out is by thinking about Newham and Forest Gate. So can you tell me a bit about those places?
Yeah, and I mean that was my plan. Whether it works, we'll see. But Newham, as I said, is a very multicultural borough now. It's one of the most multicultural boroughs in the UK. It's got, you can see in a place like Newham the kind of historical activities of the British Empire and how people come to be in a particular place. And it has this kind of curious history of being, having this tradition of left-wing politics. I think at one time Newham Council had all Labour councillors. There was no opposition. But at the same time, if we're thinking back a few decades in the kind of 70s and 80s, it also had this far-right perspective as well. It was an area of National Front activity and then BNP activity. And so the racial politics of the place are difficult and challenging. But at the same time, the young people that I'm talking about now have found a way of having some kind of sense of belonging to this place, while at the same time drawing on their cultural histories and heritage as well. And what interests me and fascinates me about Newham is that for a long time it was a kind of outlier. So it was the East End on the edge of the East End before you got to West, before you got to London, Essex. And it is the place, or one of the places, that young people come together and grime comes out of and so on. So we have all of that. And then we arrive at a point where Newham becomes desirable, it becomes affordable, it becomes attractive. And then the shape of the place and the population changes again. And it's those changes, those differences, how people move in and through that space, how they leave their mark on those places and spaces, that I was trying to contextualize and then try to tell these stories about how young Black lives survive and thrive in these spaces as well, to kind of tell those very human stories that get left out of statistics and the kind of writing about things as issues only without the humanity there.
Yeah, I think that story of thriving obviously comes through in the story of the music and some of the artists you kind of highlight in the middle of the book. And I think one way of sort of getting to that is to think about those changes that you mentioned as well, about, you know, the area becoming desirable. And there's maybe like two things going on that I got a sense from the book. One is that story of gentrification and social segregation, and maybe we'll talk about that shortly. But the other thing was, and, you know, correct me if I've kind of misread this, but was a sense of the area being desirable as a site for making money through privatization and the outsourcing of service provision. And I found this really interesting because it almost kind of introduces or frames the book the way that these big kind of outsourcing companies, so, you know, Carillion, Serco, G4S, some of the companies you mentioned, how they, you know, there's a quote from one of the senior managers about, you know, kind of making sure they're still allowed to take the public shilling, you know, making sure there aren't kind of threats to that revenue. And I was really interested in how the place had become desirable for those organizations and how they kind of, I guess, you know, claim to provide and fail to provide public services.
I think for those organizations, those service organizations, it is a place of opportunity. Local authorities are hard pressed in terms of their finances and the services that they have to deliver, particularly if they have to deliver services to and for a population that are also struggling. And so it seems cost effective and sensible to outsource those services to those big organizations. But they're far removed from the everyday workings of people's lives. And so I'm sure all of those profit margins and profits are a matter of public record. But that doesn't translate into wages, doesn't translate into living standards for the majority of the populations in these places. And so I think I'll give the example of a custody officer in a prison earning just about the national average wage. But the national average wage would cover, doesn't cover 1 month's rent on a one-bedroom flat in a place like Newham. So the disparities and the inequalities are there for all to see. It's just how do we navigate that? How do we level it up so that the work that people do, which has value, which is important, and that's there for all to see. How do we level it up so that people can have those things, housing, affordable housing, you know, jobs that don't damage their emotional and physical well-being? And that's the kind of that's what I was trying to work through. Some of the things that I'm trying to work through in Terraformed, how do we do that? Because we have to.
I guess that's where your ideas about hyperlocal demarcation are important. So I was interested in that kind of theoretical contribution. It'd be good to hear about that.
Yeah, and I was trying to find a way to look at the issues that I'd identified in terms of young black lives. So to take to move away initially from a broad brush, and it is this idea for me about understand this C. Wright Mills and the understanding the life of an individual, and how can we do that? How can we understand society if we don't look at the lives of individuals as well? So I took the position that I was going to look at a very, very local spot, a very local spot to contextualise, try and contextualise the history of Newham and how young black lives have been affected by those changes in a place like Newham. And then I went even smaller. I thought, well, not the whole of Newham. Let me look at one of the more desirable places now. Let me look at Forest Gate in particular. And not all of Forest Gate, just a particular spot, a rough square mile. And let me look at the changes in that very, very localised space. And so I had the shape of what I was looking at, but how do I look at that? And so that was the theoretical perspective that I developed and used. So to look at the interaction between legislation and policy, town planning, communities, and the sonic landscape, all of those things together and the impact that they have on young people's lives, and especially in a place that's newly gentrified. And if we look at those things in that way, then we not only get a sense of some of those changes that have happened, but I think as well that we can take that and look at the bigger societal picture as well. We can look at other areas in other places, not even necessarily in the UK, maybe, that we can look at how those changes have impact, because they come together in a particular way. You can have this idea that you're going to improve the landscape through town planning. You're going to improve the high street. You're going to make it have a more village feel, and so on, which is a good idea and a good thing. But at the same time, in having that good idea about giving a village feel, who gets displaced? Who gets moved away? Who is not able to freely move in that space in the same way once those changes have been made? If communities, how do communities come together? They come together through leisure. If you can only access leisure, if you can pay for it, then who gets pushed out? The people that cannot pay for leisure are not then in those community spaces. So it becomes, when you start looking at the different layers in these very hyper-local spots and spaces, you start to see where the patterns are and how it happens that some people occupy exclusionary spaces.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I'm really struck by the gentrification story, actually, and particularly that kind of, you know, exclusivity. So you give loads of examples later on in the book, you know, stuff from estate agents, how the area is kind of like, you know, marketed and sold. But I was struck by the kind of like individual personalized experiences of exclusion, which, you know, sometimes when we read kind of, you know, urban theory or urban sociology, there's a sense of, you know, yeah, these things have happened, money has flowed in, blah, blah, blah. But I was really struck by your own experiences of the farmer's market, of the coffee shop, of the pub, of how, you know, You'd have shops next to market stalls where there was a really clear segregation between who'd go to the market stall and who'd go into the shop. I'm interested if you could bring out a couple of those examples to give a sense of that kind of social and spatial segregation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I thought, well, you know, I walk past these places every day, you know, or almost every day, but I hadn't been in the new coffee shops. I'd walked past the farmers market, but I hadn't stopped there. So I went along. I'd seen the changes to the pub that's at the centre of the centre of the story. But I hadn't been there, and I wondered why I hadn't. So I thought, well, you know, I went along, and yeah, there is something about watching multicultural Forest Gate or Newham walk past the window of a place, and you're sitting in that place, but you're pretty much the only black person in there. And I wonder how, because I don't know, I don't think it's deliberate, but it's about tastes and what tastes have value and what leisure activities have value and what's on offer and how you can get into those spaces. You need the price of a meal to sit in the pub or the price of a drink to sit in the pub. Not everybody has that. And so when going into those spaces for me was interesting, challenging, you know, very comfortable, very pleasant, but at the same time that feeling of, well, where is everybody else? Where is everybody else that's like me? And so the book does have that kind of ethnographic element to it, because I thought it was important to talk about those things as well. So it is an academic book, but it does have those kind of personal reflections as well, to just ground it, to ground the study, because I'm not talking about other people as objects and other people's stories as objects. I'm talking about something that's happened to us in places like this.
What about the music then? Because, you know, the sort of, I guess that story of gentrification, of privatization is one, maybe half of the book, and it runs, you know, throughout the book. But obviously, like, you know, the real kind of heart of the book, over and above Forest Gate even, is the music. Mm. And I guess before we do anything, we sort of probably have to explain what grime is. I'd kind of hope British listeners would know what grime is by now, but it might be a genre that is, you know, kind of unfamiliar to US or other international listeners. So, yeah, could you introduce it a bit, sort of, you know, maybe say a bit about what it is as a genre?
I would say that grime is usually wrapped over 140 beats per minute. It's influenced by reggae, dancehall, hip hop, UK garage, and it's a very English, British expression, creative expression. It's black British contemporary music. Rap is similar but slower, and so in the early grime days, that you could probably identify particular themes that people would rap about, and it's got a very local feel, and it was a very local genre that now has this kind of national, international reach. There's grime is global in the same way that rap is, but it emerged from and started out from these East London sites of conviviality. Young people coming together and making music that sounded like them and that mattered for them. And the community spaces are very important because it's where young people could come together. It was very DIY, especially in the early days. So people had to share resources. and so on. So I would say it's a Black British contemporary musical expression that is made by many and enjoyed by many around the world now.
And how does it kind of present or actually maybe represent Forest Gate? You've got a couple of kind of case studies around videos from various artists and various kind of moments. And obviously they're in like really kind of stark and almost critical contrast with the sorts of regeneration and gentrification plans that we talked about. So what's the kind of Forest Gate story in grime?
Well, the Forest Gate story that I was trying to tell in grime and rap, actually, was I think that the first video in there that I talk about is from 2008, so quite early days, but not that early. And it really is just a group of teenagers, and there's one MC at the front, Mini Sparks, and he's putting the work in. He's practicing his rhymes. He's got his people behind him. You have all the group shots, you know, people sitting on the wall. It's filmed probably on an early camcorder because the footage is quite grainy. And then we kind of move on to 2012 and the Woodgrange video, Woodgrange E7 video, which was originally posted up around the time of the Olympics and then got taken down as part of the council's drive to remove anything that they said had a gang reference. And then it got reposted again with a disclaimer and very similar visual themes, but over a rap beat, talking very locally about the area, about Woodgrange Road. You get all the scenes from the local area as well. And then rolling on to the last video, which is Bassman and Snizzy, filmed from a rooftop. And you can see the quality get better and as the years go on. And by the time we get to Bassman and Snizzy, there's a kind of weariness, I think, a kind of sadness. And even though we have this long view of the area, it feels a little bit more melancholy, the kind of youthful playfulness that's evident in the first video has gone a little bit. And I think what I was trying to do with those stories is to look at, well, where are the places that filming can happen, where people can gather? And you know, those blocks in the first video, they're no longer available. They're not there anymore. Not in the same way. They're not accessible in the same way. Steel doors, intercoms, and so on. So you can't gather in those places. And also the legislation in terms of ASBOs and public space protection orders don't allow young people to gather in the same way. So the music tells many, many stories about Forest Gate in particular. And Bassman has another video, a track that's specifically about Forest Gate. It's part of the SBTV Better Place series, where artists up and down the country, rhyming over the same beat, talk about their area. And he talks about coming to Forest Gate and finding a new place to call home. And I think that resonates particularly with young people whose families have come from different places recently or otherwise. There are many, many themes and threads in there, in the music, that kind of hold you and give you space to reflect and think.
You mentioned, I guess, the kind of the story of spatial exclusions and changes in the area. And obviously, you know, there are kind of bigger trends in that area of London around things like the Olympics. And you know, you mentioned kind of, you know, the how this extends into censoring of attempts to kind of transmit or make available the music. Mm-hmm. But there's a really kind of, you know, practical element to these stories of kind of, you know, spatial or changes in access to places, and that's how the area is policed. And obviously, like, you know, stories of gentrification can seem as if they're just kind of processes of, you know, money comes in, populations come in, there is, you know, segregated use of shops or whatever. But actually, later on in the book, you give these really clear examples of effectively a kind of, you know, a hostile environment that is, you know, anti-youth, anti-black, and, you know, policing that is particularly kind of, hostile and aggressive.
Mm. Well, the use of various bits of legislation, so criminal legislation, but also other bits of legislation as well in terms of immigration policy, mental health, and so on. And I think that Newham uses the kind of Section 60, which is where you can say about a few streets or a particular area that the police don't have to have particular grounds to stop and search. If there's a threat of violence in a particular area. I think it was originally used for football match days. But now it's used quite regularly, so that if there's an idea or there's been an incident, and what that means is that anybody within that area can get stopped and searched. And so it might be a recent use of a piece of legislation, but that hostile environment towards black youth goes back decades. You know, you can trace the line back to the use of SUS and so on. And I do give some past examples of that in the book as well, so that we can see that there's a history and a pattern to how some sections of our communities are policed and how often they're policed more harshly than others. And then what does that do? What does that do to individuals who are on the receiving end? How does behaviour change? What stories do we tell ourselves about how we interact with those regulating authorities if there have been decades of this hostile environment and so on? And it's another part of the story or the stories that I'm trying to tell, that you have to look at how legislation is put into place and who is subject to it as well, and in what ways they're subject to it, because it's not always the same and it's not experienced in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's a really important insight from the book, and it comes through, you know, really sort of personally as well throughout the book. And I think it's something that people really should take time to engage with and read for themselves in the book. I guess the place to kind of conclude is around where this fits into your kind of research more generally. It strikes me that there's loads of kind of possible strands of research that come from the book, and there's, you know, possible research agendas that you could develop. Or is it a case of, in writing the book, that, you know, you'd like to move on to something maybe completely different in terms of your thought? Where are you thinking of developing next?
I think I'm at the point now. I'm not done with this by a long chalk. I think what this book has allowed me to do is collect some of my thoughts and ideas together and kind of put them in some kind of context. It's really important, I think, for Black communities and all of us to remember about our history in this place. There's been a kind of collective forgetting about why we're here and how we came to be here and what our contribution is. And that collective forgetting allows us to ignore some of the symbolic and structural violence that we've had to exist within and survive with and flourish out of. And music is, and creativity is one of the ways that that we've done that. And so I think more and more for me, it's about placing those histories, that work, those societal contributions at the forefront of what's being written and what's being said. So, yeah, I think for me, I thought it was an endpoint when I was writing it, Dave, but actually it's probably the starting point of a number of other projects as well.